reminders that I have. And so while I'm going to go ahead and turn off the screen share here, and Carl, if you could go ahead and start to pull up your presentation materials, please go right ahead. And as Carl is doing this, I'll just welcome everybody to our topic, which will cover the use of remedial action levels and cleanup levels with contaminated sediment management. Well, so we'll be joined by Carl Gustafson, coming to you from EPA. Now, the presentation here is to provide an understanding of what remedial action levels are and how they're used at contaminated sediment sites. And this presentation is also going to discuss how the RALs differ from cleanup levels and then how both of them are used in the cleanup process. So these RAL concentrations represents concentrations that trigger active construction for sediment cleanup. And this can consist of different combinations of dredging, capping, enhanced natural recovery, and monitored natural recovery to address contaminated material at Superfund sediment sites and to reduce the contaminant exposure to human health and the environment. So I'm going to leave the opening instructions there. And Carl, I'll just remind you, your camera's on. That's great. Let me go ahead and focus the audience on you instead of me. And then if you want to go ahead into your slideshow mode, I'll confirm that they are up. And Carl, if you want to go ahead and unmute. So I see the slides, but we're not in presentation mode yet. So if you want to go there. There we go. Perfect. Slides look good. Carl, I'll turn it over to you to begin the presentation.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Jean. And thank you also to Region 10. Region 10 was sort of the impetus of this presentation and wanting to have sort of a format to be able to communicate a couple of these issues with their stakeholders, members of the community. And it sort of expanded from that and have an opportunity to have a broader conversation with folks that are in the sediment remediation community. And there's certainly a need for it, I think, as evidenced by the number of participants that are here today. And so I want to start out just on the title slide. So you're not in the wrong talk, by the way. The title slide is different, intentionally different than the topic that we're going to be talking today about. And really gets to the fact that when we describe remediation goals are an umbrella that sort of covers the cleanup levels and also the use of the remedial action level. We're going to talk a lot about that today, but that's just sort of a kickoff for that. And the title also helps to focus where we're going here and talking about the fish tissue exposure pathway at our contaminated sediment sites. The overall objective here today is really to get a better shared understanding of the terminology that we have and the basis of that terminology, both in policy and guidance. And the practice for how we implement implement those terms within the construct of Superfund and considerations around those. And you know, it's a complex subject, remediation goals. If you had to look at the whole scope of Superfund site decision making, it's probably one of the most controversial areas and one of the most complex areas as far as driving these remediation goals. And I think in the same vein, it's challenging also to communicate that out. So it's a challenge that I'll have today. I mean, on the line today, we have a lot of different folks, a lot of folks from different locations, different organizations, a lot of folks with different experiences and different perspectives and different backgrounds. So I think the talk in general is going to leave some folks looking for more and other folks perhaps hoping it would end sooner. One thing I can promise to you is that I appreciate you and I appreciate you being here, spending this time on your day and your life here with me to discuss this with you. And I will respect that time and I will hopefully be able to achieve our objective of enhancing our shared understanding of this. Or at least to mock, to not make things worse as we talk about both the I'm going to put on my laser pointer here, both on the policies that drive our remediation goals and the practice. So I want to start out this presentation, like I start out a lot of presentations, kind of going from big picture down to small picture, you know, thinking about funneling down all the various topics that we can have within the Superfund framework into what we're really looking at. So first thing I'll do though is kick it off with a couple of caveats. You know, the first being that we are going to be discussing a lot of these different topics, And we're going to be discussing policy, or we're going to be discussing regulation, or discussing how that's actually implemented at sites. This discussion doesn't override, it doesn't constitute, and it doesn't replace or change any of the guidances that are there. EPA's policy is represented by our guidances, by our regulation, of course, by the CERCLA law or the Superfund law that drives all of those. The other thing is that I'm not going to be getting into specific, you know, site-specific topics today. I'm going to have a number of examples, but as far as site-specific questions go, the best resource for your site-specific questions is going to be your RPMs and your regional experts, folks that know all the specific aspects of that. So getting into the presentation, really what we're working with here is risk to human consumers, consumers of fish tissue. Fish tissue that's going to be contaminated from our site releases. And when we conduct remediation, really what we're doing is we're conducting sediment remediation to reduce risk to consumers of these fish. So that helps us really narrow things down here. One, we're going to be looking at Superfund sites. And contaminated sediment remediation is done in a lot of different places by a lot of different groups. We've got, of course, other groups within EPA, for example, RCRA or our Great Lakes National Program Office, great resources for a lot of good sediment remediation that is undertaken. And we've got our state counterparts. We're underneath state programs. State remediation occurs quite frequently. And we also have our international counterparts where remediation also occurs. I'm focusing on Superfund, and I'm focusing on the remedial program within Superfund. I think there's a lot of applicability of those concepts, of those, and even of the terminology to other sites and to other programs, but really that's what I'm focusing on. The second thing is we're going to be looking at sediment sites and again on our fish tissue exposure pathway. So kind of narrowing our universe down from all the things that we can be talking about to what we're specifically talking about today. And when I think about this, so many of our sites are contaminated by our persistent hydrophobic and bioaccumulative contaminants, contaminants like PCBs, contaminants like dioxins. That's also going to be a focus of what we talk today, particularly with regard to the fish tissue exposure pathway. And when we think about remediating for those things, in essence, what we're doing is we're remediating sediments to remediate the risk that we have from fish consumption. And that's sort of the bottom line here. But it gets, you know, there's a lot to that and it's not entirely straightforward. So we're gonna walk through that. And first I wanna highlight here the agency's rule book, right? This is the NCP, this is the National Contingency Plan. Which sounds like it could be a little bit dry or something along those lines, but actually it's not. It's actually a very good read, and it sets us up well for implementing the program. And I'm just going to walk through this a little bit slowly because it is really important. And so, you know, at EPA, we do a lot of reviews of sites and of decisions and along those lines. And I think that these first couple quotes here are those that we hearken back to probably most often in thinking about how to implement the program. And really, so I'll walk through it a bit slowly because part of the issue is this terminology and what it means and when it should be applied. So the agency shall establish our remedial action objectives that specify contaminants and media of concern and potential exposure pathways and remediation goals. So first off, our remedial action objectives. Our remedial action objectives are really what you intend to get done at the site. And I'm talking about a remedial action objective that refers to reducing the risk from the consumption of contaminated fish. Your site may have other remedial action objectives. For example, perhaps there's a source control objective or an objective to address direct that's related to other exposure pathways, like addressing direct contact or risks related to surface waters at the site. But I'm talking about the remedial action objective being this general narrative statement, being like, we intend to reduce risk to human health from fish contaminated above acceptable level, from fish contaminated above acceptable levels. So we're supposed to have these REOs that specify our contaminants, PCB, our media, fish or sediments, our exposure pathway through the consumption of fish, and our remediation goals. So that's where we kind of get down to brass tacks here, this remediation goals. And the remediation goals, it basically says that the remediation goals shall establish the acceptable levels that are protective of human health in the environment. And so you'll hear in this presentation today that we talk about both acceptable and protective levels. And that comes from the statement that the remediation goal shall establish the acceptable exposure levels that are protective of human health in the environment. So the NCP then gets into what our decisions will entail. And it says, you know, the ROD shall indicate, you have to indicate your remediation goals that the remedy is expected to achieve. And performance shall be measured at appropriate locations. So not only do you have to say where you're going with the remediation goals, but also how you're going to measure that you got to that point. So I know that that's a lot sort of buried into this slide, and I'm going to get into it a little bit more. I don't want to belabor it, but again, there's a lot to it, and it's somewhat confusing. And I'm just trying to hope my explanations won't increase that confusion. But one of the reasons it's confusing is because the terms sort of change and adapt along the way through the process, through the Superfund process over time, as the needs change and as more information is collected. You can think about it. So we also always hear about PRGs, PRGs being the preliminary remediation goals, preliminary meaning, of course, early in the process. And here's a couple quotes from both our risk assessment guidance as well as from our ROD guide, as well as from our ROD guidance, that sort of talks about that change and that evolution in terminology, where our PRGs are going to be refined into our final RGs or our final remediation goals throughout the process leading up to remedy selection. Now in the ROD itself, that should include a statement of our final cleanup levels. That's the first time you're hearing me say cleanup levels that are going to be based on these goals. And so, you know, what we're seeing here is that our PRGs, our preliminary remediation goals, are going to be stated as final remediation goals once we lead up to remedy selection. But when we get into the ROD, we're going to call those final cleanup levels. And our final cleanup levels, just like we mentioned from the NCP, those are going to establish our contaminant-specific exposure levels that are protected. And it also says, so now in the ROD, it's preferable to use the term remediation level or cleanup level rather than remediation goal. So once we get into the ROD, we're going to be focus on the cleanup level, and that cleanup level is going to be consistent with the NCP's requirement to have an protective and acceptable level. So that's the connection there. And that's why so many of these terms sort of can get mixed up and can get can be expressed differently. And you know, I think that there's difficulty with that. And that's why I added this box on the side, this variation in terms, how it can foster confusion. This is actually a list that was pulled through various documents that have been decision documents that have been created over time, some from a long time ago. And what they really do is they show some of the examples of the language that was used, and it represents a challenge. You know, in Superfund, one of our best resources, on policy at Superfund, she always tells me, you know, Carl, the words matter. And indeed, the words do matter, especially when you get something as important as remediation goals and your cleanup levels that designate where your remediation is going to go. So it really does matter. So it's just a word of encouragement to try to stick with the terms and their meaning, how they progress through the Superfund process. And of course, if your site-specific needs make it so that you need a different term, you should talk about what those terms were and how they fit into this broader context. So that's really how our remediation goal umbrella fits in with all of these other terms. Another note on this remediation level here, This remediation level is synonymous with cleanup level. It's not the remedial action level. The remedial action level we're going to be talking about in a little bit. That's a risk management tool that's used to get us to our cleanup level. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. And I hope this hasn't been overly boring or confusing getting through these aspects of it. So fish tissue remedial goals and its process to then derive sediment remedial goals or sediment cleanup goals. So deriving our protective fish tissue concentrations, how do we actually do this, right? I'll step back to the beginning here again. Really, we recognize that risk is going to be a function of both our chemicals hazard and our exposure to that. Now, the chemicals hazard, that relates to the properties of the chemical that can cause adverse effects to the receptor, being people or to wildlife. And that hazard is documented and developed by EPA's IRIS program, the Integrated Risk Information Systems program, where they evaluate the dose response between these chemicals and the effects that it can have. And they actually produce both cancer slope factors and reference doses. These are factors that come out of IRIS that basically express that dose response relationship. And we combine that hazard with then our exposure. And exposure, again, through our fish tissue consumption pathway is going to be fish tissue consumption, how much we eat. You can see in this graph here, basically we're expressing that relationship for a non-cancer endpoint. So this is toxicity endpoints that aren't related to cancer to humans. And it basically shows that the more meals you eat per month, the less of that PCB that you can be exposed to not go above that health effect level. And this is the way that we then can say, when we have exposure at different levels, what's the concentration of PCB that can be allowed in our fish to not exceed these risk levels? And so you have these relationships. And if these particular numbers don't look like the numbers at your site, you know, really that's okay. This is just an example. This is an example for PCBs looking at a hazard quotient of one for non-cancer. If you were going to look at cancer, you would have a different you would have different levels that would be expressed there. When, for example, you were going to look at an excess cancer risk of 10 to the minus 6, they would be lower than these numbers, or 10 to the minus 4th, they would be higher than those numbers. I know there's a lot loaded in that terminology and process, but basically here, this is how we're able to understand the concentration in the fish that's related to particular levels of consumption. And it might be different at your site. There's going to be specific exposure modifications. Whether or not we're going to use a whole fish, whether or not we're going to use a flay with skin on and off, the types of fish that's going to be in that consumption, and whether or not, for example, there's reductions from cooking, how long the duration folks are exposed. And this is one of our big ones, the consumption rates. The rates I showed up above were generally for recreational anglers. But there are folks, there are different communities, subsistence communities, indigenous communities that have far greater fish tissue consumption rates. And those numbers can then result in far lower contaminant concentrations within fish that can be consumed without exceeding those risk levels. And that's basically what we're showing here, is that there's going to be these site-specific exposure modifications that can have that acceptable level in fish back to the acceptable level in fish again that you're going to try to achieve as part of your remediation goal. So then we got to take the jump from our acceptable level in fish down to our sediment concentration. And how that's typically done is through just having a relationship between those two. You can understand where if fish are going to be exposed to a concentration in sediment that would then result in their own concentration if they spent enough time there. And there's a couple of different ways that we oftentimes do that. One of the ways is that we'll model it using, here's an example of just a graphic of one of those models, trophic trace, that looks at the effect of the sediment concentration on components of the diet and the water concentration up to the things that we were just talking about, or fish tissue concentrations. Another way to do it is through this BSAF, which is more of an empirical or an observation that you would have where you're looking at the concentration that you have in the sediment as a ratio to the concentration that you have in fish. And as you can see, that sort of ratio that you would have in here too, two different ways to get at the same thing. What's the relationship between your sediment and your fish? So in this regard, those protective or acceptable fish tissue concentrations can then have a corresponding protective or acceptable sediment concentration. And this is going to be a site-specific relationship. And at some sites, you can see where if your acceptable fish tissue concentration was quite low, then your sediment concentration would also be quite low. And generally, it's lower in magnitude because things like PCBs do bioaccumulate from the sediment up into the fish. So you'll have your sediment level be of lower magnitude. And that can create an issue where it's actually potentially lower than background, lower than what you would anticipate at the site without the circular release, without the circular related contaminants. So that's one interesting that's one interesting aspect, and it can make things more or less challenging depending on how you look at it. But it's certainly part of the process. And then these models, like any models, they're going to be subject to uncertainties and various assumptions. And you can see that sort of borne out here, right? Here we have this convenient little box, right, where we've got our sediment, we've got our dietary constituents, our water, and our receptors, and we're able to figure this out all within a box, all within a spreadsheet, all by our algorithm. But things aren't always so straightforward. There are a number of assumptions. And one of the main assumptions that we look at here is, what is the sediment bed that's driving the exposure to our fish? And there's many, many assumptions. I just want to talk about one of them right now. I'm going to give a couple of examples of it, to talk about the types of challenges that are there, and to also highlight the importance of thinking about these challenges when you go developing your remediation goals from your remedial action objectives. So I'm going to be talking about basically fish exposure areas. And I'm not talking about, in this context, the areas where humans are exposed to fish. I'm not talking about like where folks go fishing and they fish from here, they fish from there. I'm talking about where the fish themselves are exposed to the sediment bed and to their dietary constituents that will drive the fish tissue contaminants. Because ultimately, those fish tissue contaminants will be the vector to humans and relate to the human health risk. So I'm going to give a couple of examples as we walk through here, again, reminding us that sediment cleanup levels, they're going to be derived from our fish tissue, from our acceptable fish tissue contaminant levels. And just like in that last one where we had that simple box, we're going to have a representation of that well as well. And you can see this is a hypothetical site example where we have a reservoir, and our site here is just going to be a small corner of the site. You can understand that, you know, for example, this is where the release was, this is where the release is contained, and this is the site, and this is the area we're going to be addressed. And that would then be the area, the sediment bed that we would be interested in, the surplus site release, how it relates to our fish tissue contaminants. And that's going to be a very different relationship than if we had, for example, this is our site, where the entire reservoir is going to be our site. So when we think about it being sediment concentrations and fish concentrations, this is what we're talking about, the sediment concentrations. And so it's very important to obviously recognize where our sediment bed is that's going to drive that relationship. At the same time, I think it's also very important to recognize where our fish are being exposed, this fish exposure area. And in that regard, it's important to it's important to think about fish movement and the resulting uncertainty, particularly if you're going to think about whether or not your fish can do a couple of the roles that we would hope that they'd be able to do, which would be one, to represent the risk to your receptors at your site, and two, the effect of the remediation. To make that linkage between remediating your sediments and your fish tissue concentrations actually going down, which is what, of course, we would anticipate with our remedial action objective. So this is just a very simple example of that, but it's actually showing some actual fish tracking data where they were able to establish the location of the fish through a couple of different technologies. And thinking about one fish during the course of the day, these are both the same fish species. And it shows that basically it's this area here. It's hard to see, but these are the data points that represent that fish's movement during the day and its association with the site. So it would be well within the confines of the first site, and of course within the second site that we talked about as well. Here's a second fish. This is a second fish from that same day, same species, same, you know, it's one of its cohorts. And basically what we saw was it moved well across what would have been outside of our hypothetical site to other areas. And during that same day, came back. It was also on the other side of the peninsula. So it took a large foray during the night, came back. And we have to think about what that would mean as far as its exposure area. Where is it going to be exposed to? And we know from our fish studies that our fish exposure is going to vary between our species, can vary among individuals, can vary between seasons. And then the other added sort of like issue that you'd want to think about there is, what does that mean for its chemical exposure? We know, especially for a lot of these persistent organic compounds, that they get their primary exposures through their diet. And how does that interface with this sort of different type of exposures? I'm going to highlight that in a couple of other examples that I think are very useful. This was a study that was done by the Great Lakes National Program Office. I was associated with the study and the Army Corps of Engineers. And it was a way of looking at that question, a way of thinking about at this site, which is in the Great Lakes, thinking about carp. And carp were one of the most contaminated fish that existed at the site. And it was seeking to understand the degree to which the carp associate with the site and where they associate with the site. So it's very interesting what was done. These fish were tagged, a cohort of the fish were tagged, native fish pulled from the environment, and they were monitored to see where within the site they spent time. Here's a highlight of that, sort of a heat map that demonstrates that indeed they had specific areas of focus. They didn't tend to spend time like averaging out throughout the entire site, but it had specific areas of focus. This other panel shows something that is also interesting. This is over the entire course of the study, how much time it spent within the site compared to outside the site. And generally what we see is that there are only a couple of the fish that spent the majority of the time within the site out of all those, this is the percent of time within the study hours that it was actually within the site compared to outside the site. So although these fish were contaminated and were within the site, and if they were going to get caught by humans within the site, they would certainly constitute a risk. It's very challenging to say that all the PCBs in those fish were directly related to the site. Perhaps you could say that if this was the only area of contamination in the region, but it's not the only area of contamination in the region. So it just helps you to understand that this might not be the best indicator of remedial effectiveness, for example, if this area was going to be remediated. Here's another example that's similar to that. It's also very telling because it helps us understand some of our fish tissue data. Our fish tissue data can be pretty confusing, pretty complex because of their wide level of variability. You're going out and you're collecting fish from the same location and they look the same, they're the same size, they're ostensibly cohorts, but they can vary quite a lot in their level of contamination. So why is that? You know, what are the drivers of And I think that this fish exposure area is pretty important. And what we see here is in our fish tissue contaminant is this a little bit of a different representation of fish tissue contaminants. Really, it's showing the number of fish and the level that they were at. Most of the fish here were relatively uncontaminated compared to some of the fish that were quite high in contamination or DDT. This is the Palaesferidae shell. And what we see here is they also did a fish tracking study where they got a large number of fish and they released those fish at the site. They caught them from the site, they tagged them, they released them, they monitored their movement. And what they see is that right away, a lot of them left the site. Some of them hung around the site for a little bit, but most of them left. And then some of them hung out around the site, about 10% of them hung around the site for an extended period of time. And if you think about it, although it's not a direct causation between that exposure and these concentrations, those sort of patterns look quite similar and could help you to understand those sort of outcomes. So I want you to think about those things in particular when we about fish exposure areas and this variation. And the effect that it could have on contaminants. And I think that this is particularly important when we select fish and we think about these areas and whether or not those fish are able to represent our site or our site is able to represent those fish, whether or not we're able to make that connection between that linkage between the remediation and our fish tissue concentrations. And this circles back then, of course, to whether or not and to what extent those fish can be useful representations in our RAO and should be subject to our establishing a remediation goal. So I think that it's real important to have that because at the end of the day, you don't want to be establishing objectives that you can't achieve, and this is in the decision-making process, or after remediation, seeking to look at whether or not your remediation goals in fish tissue were achieved, when in reality they might, maybe it wouldn't be realistic for them. So it's important to make those linkages. And there's also a tendency to think about this like, oh my gosh, I have a lot of receptors and a lot of fish species. This stuff is incredibly complex. And, you know, as a scientist who's interested in this stuff, I'm perfectly willing to go down all sorts of rat holes chasing, you know, where these things are and what it means and all these things. But that isn't really the point of the program. And the program being the Superfund program. And, you know, I really have to hearken back to these first principles when we think about the uncertainty. Oh, where's my fish? What's this doing? How does it relate to things? I think that it's very important for us to understand and to be thoughtful about. But at the end of the day, EPA has a stated bias for action in the face of uncertainty. And I've got some examples here, some example quotes from the NCP preamble, which is a really interesting read. I kind of hesitate to say that because how interesting is a person that says that the NCP preamble is a really interesting read, but it really is. It really helps to understand what went into the decisions there. And what we're talking about here is that EPA has to balance the desire to definitively characterize all these risks and uncertainties with the desire to implement our protective measures quickly. And we are expressly told within the NCP to accommodate those in the derivation of our remediation goals. The remediation goals consider our ARRs, whether or not there's a specific, for example, federal standard, acceptable risk. And we talked a lot about the acceptable risk in the earlier presentation on deriving fish tissue concentration. Technical limitations, those can include background, uncertainty, and other pertinent information. At the end of the day, the ultimate decision on what level is going to be appropriate depends on the selected remedy. And the criteria. So really what this gets at is that it is certainly important to recognize the uncertainties and to accommodate the uncertainties, but we are driven to make to make decisions and move forward and actually have a high degree of flexibility in making those decisions and moving forward. And we see that in the way that sediment remedies are developed. And I think that it's both the beauty and the blight in Superfund, right? That we have this flexibility, because at some level you wish that you could just look at the table or your PCBs and figure out to what level should I remediate my sediments. That would be great. We don't have that, but that would be oversimplistic for a number of the sites. I mean, our sites in Superfund, just in the sediment world, they vary tremendously. I mean, we have sites that are single outfalls that go into surface water, and they range from those single outfalls out to miles and miles of the continental shelf in the ocean, in the open ocean. So between those two things, you have to have your policies and procedures be able to accommodate that. So I think necessarily you have to have that flexibility. And that's just on site configuration. What about all our variation in human behaviors? What about all our variation in fish behaviors? And that's just looking at the uncertainties that we have. And we have processes, we have the ability to parameterize all these things, whether it's averages or whether it's exposure area weighting, all these different things that help us to help our RPMs to get to these remedial goals and to help the evaluation of achieving those remedial goals through our various ways of remediation. And a couple of examples here. And there is going to be variation in how these are achieved. A couple of the remediation approaches that we see out in the field, I mean, we see at various sites are to look at a remedial action level, a REL. And I'm going to talk extensively about that, about what a REL is, and then use MNR after you've achieved that REL. Some sites, we just use institutional controls. There isn't active remediation. There are institutional controls to reduce the exposures, if that's where the NCP analysis drives us to. There's remediation to a background-based cleanup level, and there's a combination of using a RAL, this remedial action level, to achieve a site-wide cleanup level. This RAL SWAC seawell approach. I haven't talked about SWACs yet, but the surface weighted average concentration. We're going to talk about that extensively in the next couple of slides. Or also using interim objectives. And an interim rod, you're not getting to that final protective acceptable level. You're doing something that's a significant step, that's an interim step to getting to that. And that's that, and you're just getting to that interim objective in the rod. So at this point, I've talked an awful lot and I've covered a lot of material. I am going to switch channels to get into specifically, as promised, the RALs and cleanup levels, and that they're and thinking about those approaches. But I want to open it up now for a couple of questions, so it's not entirely one way of me talking to the screen instead of talking to y'all in person. So, Jean, if we could please open it up for a couple of questions now, if any came in.
Sure, absolutely. So I have had a lot of questions coming in, and Carl, just like you acknowledged at the very beginning, we have a wide range in questions. We have some participants who are pretty new to the topic, and then some who are very technical and have a lot of experience here. So I'm just going to circle back to a couple of some higher level summary questions that were coming in. and if you could just sort of go back and talk a little bit, you mentioned something called IRIS, which was used, and some of the participants were just curious. They haven't heard that term before. And then those who knew of it, they just wanted to know how often is it updated, if you have any information on that.
Good question. Great questions. And thank you for everyone for entering questions. So yeah, I mentioned the IRIS reference doses in cancer slope factors. And those are published by the IRIS program at EPA. They're a tremendous asset, and thank goodness we have them. Because what they do is they basically, for PCBs, there will be a published cancer slope and reference dose. And then we're able to develop these sort of relationships between consumption and what would be a fish tissue concentration at various levels. I don't have it right in front of me, the website or whatever, but it's just IRIS EPA risk levels. I'm sure in Google, I'm sure that you could get to that program. But it's sort of a fundamental cornerstone of using these levels within our risk assessment procedures to understand the acceptable fish tissue concentrations or sediment to get to our sediment concentrations. How often they're updated? That is an IRIS program decision. I can say that I have seen some IRIS updates, and some of those IRIS updates have modified the risk levels that we use at sediment sites. And we can expect that others will occur in the future. I don't really have a timeline for that or specific knowledge of that. Perhaps that could be a subject of having IRIS folks come on for a subsequent CLUIN webinar.
Excellent. Then there were a couple of people who wrote in with some questions about the phrases or terms remediation levels or cleanup levels and then remediation goals. And so they're really looking for clarification if the remediation or cleanup level is talking about the measure of contaminant that's left behind when the cleanup is done, or is that talking about the amount that you're removing as part of the cleanup level? So they're just they're trying to clarify that term.
Thank you. And that was what I was trying to get to down here, because this is, so it's a quote from the ROD guidance. And unfortunately, this remediation level looks a lot like the term remedial action level. And if I wasn't so steeped in what I do, I would say, of course, that's the same thing, because look, it says the same thing. And so I want to apologize for being confusing and for me being confusing in that. But here, really what we're looking at is, in this quote, the remediation level is synonymous with the cleanup level. Okay. Which, of course, is synonymous here with the remediation goal, which recognizes the acceptable or protective level that we seek to achieve. So in the context of what you just said, Gene, and the commenter said, that would be basically, if you achieve your cleanup level or your remediation goal, or in this case, the remediation level, that's what's going to be, that would be the acceptable, if what you left behind was to be acceptable, mm-hmm. that would be it.
Okay.
Remediation action level is what I'm going to talk about next.
Okay. Someone chimed in, and I think this is a fair generalization. They said, it sounds like he's saying that remediation goals are where we want to go, and the remediation levels are how we measure our progress towards those goals. Would you say that's fair?
I'd say that's generally true, and I appreciate the commenter saying it better than me.
Excellent.
That's not hard to do some days, right?
Well, I think there are a couple of other ones in here. We did have some other just baseline questions about how we conduct our risk assessments. And people have a lot of questions about, you know, how fish may be moving differently if they're in a creek than they do in a lake or a bay, and talking about biological magnification. And these are a lot of, you know, very specific questions in how we conduct our risk assessments. I don't know if we have time to get into those, but will you highlight that in some of the upcoming examples or talk a little bit about some of the, how the risk was measured and sort of calculated?
So that's basically what I was talking about at the beginning, how folks are going to be wanting more and some folks are going to be wanting less. And I think that's sort of I suppose in classic Superfund context, I'm going to leave everybody a little bit unhappy. Some of those things could be discussed further. And so I brought those up, particularly in the context of our exposure areas, to basically get to the point that we need to be thoughtful about that. We need to be thoughtful about those considerations within the site-specific context to make that linkage. But those risk assessment and those risk management decisions are going to be made by your site RPM, by your site risk assessors, because they are the experts. They are the folks that are well steeped in actually what goes on at your site to be able to develop these remedies to achieve our remediation goals or our interim objectives.
Okay. I do have a few other questions. People are bringing in state cleanup levels. And so let me just read this question. They're just looking if you can address a situation where state cleanup levels are different than the EPA levels for a Superfund site. So for example, one state may have a CUL versus an EPA MCL as an ARAR, and how these two different numbers come into play at the same site.
So that's there's probably a whole lot to that question, right? So I see a CUL being a cleanup level and an MCL being a groundwater cleanup level. And so I'm sediments guy, so I could probably say that this is a groundwater issue that I won't expressly address. However, I will say this, our remediation goals consider ARARs. And if one of your state levels is an ARAR, then it's going to consider that in developing the remediation goals. That's again going to be a very site specific context where there's probably a lot of different ways that could think about that depending on the information at hand. I don't have the information to think about. Certainly, if it's an ARR, it's going to be considered in the development of the site specific remediation goal / cleanup level / CUL.
Okay. Well, there's another one that maybe we can just hit on here, the relationship between establishing a background cleanup level and state ARARs, especially if the state is using a different definition of background.
So the relationship between using a background cleanup level and state ARARs, especially if the state is using a different background level, right? So it's, I just want to make sure. Can you say it?
Sure. Can you explain the relationship between establishing a background-based cleanup level and state ARARs? Because they specifically say if the state uses a different definition of quote background, you know, how do those two things connect?
So, my first suggestion on that would be, you know, that's going to be a site specific consideration, and it's going to be driven by whether or not the agency considers that to be an ARAR, and whether or not that would be reflect on the media at hand. This quickly gets into a site specific sort of conundrum, and I guess I would have to you'd have to understand what particular ARRs we're talking about compared to the cleanup levels. I will hearken back again to the NCP, where our remediation goals can include consideration of background. That's also consistent with our background policy that says the same thing. How to deal with a potential conflict between if a potential AOR varies from a potential state ARR varies from a determination of background. You know, that's pretty site specific, but certainly the remediation goals consider both of those things.
Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time, Carl, why don't we go ahead and carry on? I'm looking at approximately 2:56 p.m. Eastern, my clock, but we will continue to invite the audience to send in their questions and comments. We will pause again later today. And then I just ask for everybody's patience. There are over 400 people on live, so there are a lot of questions that are coming in the queue. So we are doing our very best to kind of work through these in the time that we have allotted, so you can continue to submit them, and we'll pause again a little bit later. So Carl, I'll turn it back over to you to carry on with the presentation.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And thank you all for the questions. there are many different layers to this onion and nuances and nuances on our nuances at some point. So let's move now into, it was a great segue, a couple of the initial questions, thinking about the relationship between this RAL and the CUL. And that's what I'm going to get into here, to sort of highlight this approach here, because there's a lot of questions on that. And it relates to this definition between these, or the distinctions between the RALs, the remedial action levels, and the cleanup levels, and their use in contaminated sediment management. So I've got the first statement here being that our RALs are generally not our CULs. And our RALs are going to specify what is the sediment contaminant concentration that's going to be remediated. So if you're out there looking at your sediment bed, you're going to specify the contamination where it's like sediments above this level are going to be remediated. And I have here that this is oftentimes applied as a point concentration. When I say point concentration, what I mean is we're going out there, we're looking at a point on the sediment bed and sampling it and asking, are these things or are they not above the RAL? The RAL would be a sediment concentration, for example, 10 ppb, 10 ppm, you know, a concentration of the contaminant within the sediments. This is not a CUL. A CUL, as I've been talking about, is the cleanup level. And the cleanup level is a representation of the remediation goal. And that's the sediment concentration that's going to be acceptable. And in this area, and oftentimes in this fish tissue exposure pathway, we think about the fish tissue exposure area, and that's an area. It's not a point concentration. So we want our CUL, our acceptable concentration, to be over that area. And that's oftentimes applied as an area average concentration. And that's that SWAC I was talking about, the surface weighted average concentration. It's also, folks also will call it the spatially weighted average concentration. Really, it's not just a list of numbers. It's looking at the average of a list of numbers. It's weighing each of the numbers throughout an area, and we'll get into this more, and figuring out what the average concentration is, including that spatial element. So these RALs, they're a risk management tool. These RALs, these tools that we're using, they can be used to develop our various remedies or our various alternatives that are intended to be compared and evaluated through the NCP criteria. And in practice, the outcome might be is that you've got a high concentration, you might have a high concentration RAL that's going to be remediated to then achieve a lower concentration cleanup level over your larger area, your exposure area. Just a hypothetical example here. You know, what I'm talking about here is that we might have a site, 400 acre site. And based on the way that, based on the nature and the distribution of the contaminants there, you might only have to remediate 20 acres of the really hot stuff to get down to your average, to get down to an average concentration of 50 ppb throughout the whole area. We're going to talk a little bit more about how that's borne out. But that's the reality here. And I think that there's also the reality that we have our RAL that's higher than our cleanup level. And that creates, you know, a high degree of, whoa, you know, what do you actually mean by that? And I think that that's why we're having the conversation. And I think that that's also why this last bullet is very important to recognize the effect of the area size and on your contaminant distribution on the amount of contaminant that's left behind. And again, I'm only talking about one objective here to reduce fish tissue concentrations. Your site might have other objectives. It might have a source control objective, or it might have a direct contact objective related to that exposure pathway. So you have to make sure that any sort of numbers that you generate in this through this are going to be aren't going to be overridden by your other remediation goals or your other objectives. And of course, your RPM will have that in mind and look through that. But that's to say that this isn't the end all be all at some sites where there might be other objectives that drive other remediation goals. So I'm going to get into a specific example of this because I know that this is very important to a lot of folks, and it was actually the genesis of this presentation. starting back at the beginning again. Don't worry, it won't be as long with as many NCP quotes. But we're the risk at our sites is going to be from reducing fish, or I'm sorry, from consuming fish. We're going to remediate our sediment to decrease that fish tissue concentration. The fundamental question is, to what level? We have that relationship. We have that model. We have that BSAF to be able to establish that relationship, to be able to establish what sediment bed cleanup level will be associated with our acceptable fish. Only in Superfund would we have to call this fish that we can eat an acceptable fish, but that's the terminology we have. And this would be easy if everything that we did was in 250 mil beakers with a uniform sediment bed and sediment, but it's not easy and it's not uniform because fish move and we have these sediment hotspots. So again, I'm looking here at a hypothetical example about how we can handle how we can handle this sort of problem. Well, we talked about these exposure areas where the fish are. Now, one thing you'll notice is that this is me playing with PowerPoints. Our exposure areas actually don't include upland areas. I'm sorry that I didn't do a better job in pulling that together, but we should only be looking at the sediment bed within our exposure areas. But hypothetically, this is the size of our exposure area for our fish, and we have a map of our sediment contaminants distribution within those things, and within those exposure areas. And as I talked about, we need to think about what's the average contaminant concentration within these. Again, this is not it's this average concentration that we are going to compare to our cleanup level. And so if we had an example goal to achieve our cleanup level within our exposure area, we might only have to remediate a smaller area to achieve that average cleanup level throughout the exposure area that ranges from, for example, low contamination up to high contamination. You might only have to target a specific area of that. I'm going to go through that in a little bit more detail. And we use this app. We use this average because it assumes that our fish will spend its time throughout the exposure area. Again, it's not an average of a list of numbers. It's our spatially weighted average that we're able to then get an average of the sediment bed concentration over this specific space. How does this work out? So here we have our exposure area. We have our sediment bed concentration, and we're thinking about how would we remediate this? So per the NCP, per our policies, we have a no action alternative. The no action alternative clearly doesn't have a change in our sediment bed contaminant concentration. So we have our average concentration, our SWAC over our exposure area, and it's still high. It's relatively high. And that's going to end up resulting in our unacceptable fish. That, of course, is why we're out here doing work in the first place. So then we can also have a high rail, meaning a high concentration. High concentrations, there's less of that high concentration area. And this rail, this action level, is going to focus on remediating the highest concentration and lessening the exposure area average concentration. We see this. Our average concentration now went down over our exposure area. The outcome of that is that we have reduced fish tissue concentrations, but it still does not result in an acceptable fish tissue concentration in this hypothetical example. So now we have an even lower rail. That lower rail is going to target more area in our rail footprint. The amount of coverage that we have in this alternative is larger. And so more contamination is remediated. The average is lower, and that's going to result in an acceptable fish tissue concentration. So that's how these RALs, which designates that smaller area, can then achieve a cleanup level within this larger area. And that cleanup level in the sediment bed is going to relate to the acceptable fish tissue concentration, if that's what you're doing at the site. So that's the relationship between the rails and the cleanup levels and our acceptable fish. So the RAL, again, focusing on that small area. The exposure area is the area that you're going to be averaging within this to look at your cleanup level. Because we have heterogeneity in our sediment bed, we're probably going to use a SWAC for that. We're going to use spatial weighting for our average to achieve our cleanup level, our protective sediment concentration resulting in an acceptable fish. So I think we've gone over this a couple of times, but we're talking about the human effects from the fish tissue exposure pathway. These RALs, they're going to be our risk management tool for use in developing comparing remedies. These RALs show what's going to be capped or dredged, but these RALs are not our protective sediment cleanup level, but are not going to be our protective sediment concentration. That's going to be our cleanup level. In this example, you can see that we sought to look at the RALs that could achieve the CUL over the exposure area, and that's going to be measured as a SWAC. So at the end of the day, in this example, we would remediate the sediments above the RAL to achieve a SWAC CUL in the exposure area. And I'm sorry for all the acronyms in that long winding road, but that's generally why it's a little bit complex to communicate as well as to understand. So we think about this at EPA and at headquarters where I'm at, and thinking about sediment remedies. And we seek to try to have transparency in our decision documents to lessen this confusion, to increase the mutual understanding. So when we would look at a remedial action level, it's really important to be specific about these things, to talk about what footprint results from what concentration. And for a cleanup level, if you have a cleanup level, what specifically do you mean? You mean you're gonna be looking at that point concentration, a SWAC, and if you have a SWAC, over what area? And the fish tissue remediation goal, there's a lot of fish and they interact differently. What specifically are you talking about, a species over area? And are you talking about now or later? And if you're gonna be including natural recovery, recovery to what level, when, and over what time frame? These are the elements that will make a rod more able to be communicated, more able to be understood. And it's just what I'm saying here. When we have these clear statements of remedy expectations, of the concentrations, of the area, of the time frame, we know what constitutes the achievement of our RAO, of our general objective. This helps us to better understand our risk basis, why we're out there doing this, and what we can achieve. And most importantly, we have clear expectations of when we're done, because I think all of us would like to get out of the Superfund process and have acceptable protective levels. So that is it for my presentation. Thank you so much for listening, for going through this. Happy to take as many questions as we have. And on the title slide, I included my email. Folks, if you want to, I want to make this better than worse. So please set up a time to call me. We can chat about it as well.
Excellent. Well, Carl, we've got a lot of questions in the queue, and I think I've still got you here on the clock for a bit longer. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to go through some additional questions that came in before we close things out today. So this first question that I'm going to go back to is sort of a general process one, and the participant wanted to know, how does EPA decide on the acceptable levels of health risks?
That is a phenomenal question. So I would recommend that, so the remediation goals represent our acceptable levels. And the quote from the NCP documents how we go about deciding on the acceptable levels. And also the preamble to the NCP talks about how, you know, the bottom line of that, and you know, I don't need to more or less read out to you, but you know, the ultimate decision on the level of protection will be appropriate depends on the selective remedy based on that 9 NCP criteria. So I really do recommend getting into the preamble, because it is a much broader discussion of these remediation goals and how they're constituted. And those are going to be the acceptable level of risk. Of course, if we talk about the level about acceptable risk, we have specifics on that, how we anticipate. And it's borne out in this section of the NCP, where we have our cancer risk, acceptable cancer risk range, and our non-cancer specifications. So, I mean, that's to answer that question. That's how we get into it. And it's going to be colored, of course, by our site-specific determinations, because none of this is straightforward. We do not have an answer generating machine for this. This is conducted by your RPMs, by your risk assessors, by the professionals in the region that deal with this every day and deal with this specific site, of course, in consultation with our stakeholders.
Okay. We also had a sort of an add-on question there. And does the cost of cleanup as compared to the potential health effects factored into those required cleanup levels?
So again, the cost is one of the NCP criterion. So it's considered in the determination of the appropriate selected remedy. The extent to which cost influences the protective cleanup levels. We look here at the specifics that are within the NCP for what goes into deriving those remediation goals, and I'd refer the back to the specific areas for that discussion. Again, also the preamble, which does discuss that. I don't have a lot more to say about that than that. It's just really my area of background.
Okay. We had a question that came in early about biomagnification. So this participant asks, is biomagnification not addressed in BSAF?
Great question. And I am more qualified to address that. So biomagnification is included in a BSAF. So
okay.
When we talk about the distinction that I made here about a couple of different ways to make that leap between your sediment, between your fish tissue concentration and your sediment bed concentration. One of them being the model, biomagnification is definitely included in there. But your BSAF automatically includes that in there, because your BSAF basically looks at the concentrations that you observe out in the environment versus in your fish and in your sediment bed. It's really a simple relationship where we're basically looking at the lipid normalized concentration in fish over the carbon normalized concentration in your sediment bed and looking at that ratio. So to the extent to which your fish biomagnified and underwent biomagnification processes, it would have that level as long as that fish tissue concentration is in equilibrium at that point with your sediment bed concentration. So yes, biomagnification is included in the BSAF.
Okay. I have another question here, and I will use one of your acronyms, the SWAC. So the participant asks, when you're calculating the SWAC or SWAC, how do you define the exposure area? Is it the whole site above background, or do you actually look at where the actuals are physically inhabiting in that area, like the fish, where the fish inhabit in the area? And then they go on to offer some additional other examples, like what about the shellfish, which may not move from a point-based area?
Right. Perfect. Yeah. So there are many aspects to that, right? And I think that there are many aspects to it. And as you saw, or you probably heard, that that's why the outcome of what I presented here was that we have to be thoughtful about recognizing these things and the connection between the two. So it can be done in a number of different ways. How can you address this type of movement? Could it be the entire site? If that's a simplifying assumption that you're going to be using there, perhaps that's the only assumption that you can be made. without fish tracking information like this, which is really hard to get, and perhaps might be different 1 year to the next year, you would want to use that simplifying assumption that it is the entire site, because that could get you that. Other sites, for example, have used, well, we know that fish may associate with types of habitat more than other types of habitat. So there's like an area weighting factor for an area use factor where we know they spend a lot more time there. So we're going to weight that area more than an area where they don't use it as much. There are various models that look at the associations of both spatially and temporally, and it adds a lot of complexity. But there are approaches to addressing that. And Gene, there was a latter aspect that was beyond the fish tissue exposure area. Could you help me with the latter?
Yeah, they then said, well, what about shellfish?
Yeah, which, what about,
you know, sorry, move in a different way?
Absolutely. If you are looking for your protective acceptable sediment concentration and your shellfish are your exposure pathway, then you would think about what is the concentration or what is the exposure area of those shellfish. That may well be expressed as a point concentration rather than a SWAC.
Okay. So in general, you can do things differently when you have shellfish.
Yeah. The answer to everything in Superfund is often it's a site specific.
Right, it depends, right?
And that's really the truth. And again, that's both the beauty and the blight in Superfund. It's like, you know, we need to make these site specific determinations for all of these variations that we encounter.
Okay. All right. Now I have another question about the SWAC, and I'm going to read this one to you because I have a very specific example in here. If a remedial action includes removal of sediment above an RAL and placement of a thin cover, so this is not a cap, it's like 6 inches of sand, over the remediated surface, they ask, is a surrogate concentration for the cover material included in the calculation of the SWAC? Because that cover is not going to be maintained in the long term. And that's why they're asking.
Right. So I think that this gets and I didn't get into it too much, but the replacement value, replacement value question. And so, for example, if this was our rail and we placed a thin cover over this area, this grayed out rail area, I believe the question is, what would be the concentration of that grayed out area? But they used a term I didn't quite follow, a surrogate concentration. And I'm sorry, folks, that we're not talking one-on-one, but I'm just trying to get it. So perhaps you can reread that aspect of it.
So they basically say if the remedial action includes removal above the RAL and they place a thin cover, about 6 inches of sand, over that surface, is the surrogate concentration for the cover material included when you're calculating your SWAC? Because it's not going to be maintained in the long term.
Right. So the replacement concentration. So if we were then going to say, what is the post-remediation concentration of that area, we would assign that cover a concentration. And that concentration would then go into the SWAC calculations. But that's important to say that that's immediately post-remediation, right? We call that T0. Right after you drop that sand down, that concentration would be that cap material would be that concentration. Hopefully you did the construction right so that it is. It would not be unusual to then represent what would happen to that concentration over time. Perhaps we understand that there would be additional remaining concentrations depositing on that from recontamination, and then you could include those sort of projections over time and the effect that recontamination could have. Of course, that recontamination level is going to be different than what you would anticipate prior to remediation because you had just done so much remediation. So I think that that's a good comment, and to think about the differences between what happens immediately after remediation versus what you could expect in the ensuing months or years.
Okay. We also had a question here, and I think you've highlighted it, but I'll read it out. Could you discuss when more than one criteria is being used to meet goals? So for example, an approach that uses benthic diversity, toxicity, and contaminant level through a weight of evidence approach.
Yeah, so that type of decision framework, we've seen that in RODS before. Mm-hmm. And so I think in that regard, your objective would be to, so there'd be a couple ways to address this. One would be, your objective would be to reduce sediment concentrations to a level that's productive of your benthic organisms. That could be your RAO, and then you would have a remediation goal, which would assign a concentration that would be measured in the environment that would be protective of those receptors. The other way to do it would be your REO would be to reduce toxicity to the of the COCs to your benthic organisms to acceptable levels. In that case, you would be using a toxicity test then, and that would be described in your ROD. Your risk managers at the site are going to have to think about the best ways to formulate your remedial action objectives to use that endpoint of either toxicity or of your remediation or of your cleanup level that's going to be associated with that. It just depends on how you would measure that in the future. I do know that sometimes we have a tiered process where if you don't achieve that remediation goal, you can have a toxicity test out where, look, we did not achieve that remediation goal, but we understand that we do not have toxicity throughout our toxicity testing test out. So that's one way I've seen that addressed at particular sites. Again, we have so many different variations on the theme that we can't get through all of them, but we do have to start with our first principles within the NCP and derivation of the goals for our risk to then ensue through our risk managers and RPMs to get there.
Okay. Okay. We did have a very eagle-eyed attendee who noted that you were using Trophic Trace 4.0. And they wondered if that program is still in use, or if not, are there other programs you're using?
Right. Contact David Moore at Army Corps Erdic.
Okay.
And he'll set you straight.
All right. Thanks, Carl. I'm scrolling through here in terms of some of the other questions that are here. A lot of them are getting back into just specific elements of different organisms and how we calculate risk for certain types of organisms and how they might move differently in different types of waterways. And so I don't want to, go into some of those because I think they're too site specific or a very specific application of how you might calculate those risks. But we did have a question that came in earlier that talked a little bit about variability in sites by size. So like they say that some sites are really small, like under a few acres. And so there's not a really large sort of home range when you're looking at risk. And oftentimes they're still collecting fish tissue, even though that site is very, very small. And they just wondered, do you have any direction when you're, or a limitation of site size when things are that small?
Yeah, super interesting problem and comment. So, obviously it's important, but it's also important about the greater environment that you're within and whether or not there are other sources within that greater environment. So you can imagine that the answer to that is very different in a lake that has a small area when the rest of that lake is not going to be impacted by other sources compared to, for example, a harbor within a big body of water. And whether or not you're going to be able to have the receptors that are directly linked to that remediation. So I think there's two aspects of that. One is it's an important step that we are just recognizing recognizing the linkages here to ensure whether or not our REO is going to be achievable if that REO is to reduce fish tissue concentrations, as well as to understand that there may be other REOs that may be appropriate for your small localized site. You know, very often we have REOs at site to reduce the migration, to reduce the transport of contaminants, as part of a source control action, because I think that's another critical REO. It's not an REO that we specifically talked about today.
Okay, all right, and so I see one other quick question. I think we'll just go back and clarify this, because we've talked a lot about protecting or calculating risk relative to aquatic life forms, so organisms like fish, shellfish. And one of the participants just wanted to know, you know, is EPA weighting the protection of fish or shellfish or benthics different than how we might weight protection of humans?
Well, our mission statement is to protect human health and the environment, and we derive acceptable fish tissue concentrations for acceptable and protective concentrations for the receptors that are at risk. So I think that we have had remediations that have been intended to address ecological risk, and we have many that are intended to address human risk. I will say that oftentimes the levels that impact human risk are lower at a lot of our sites are lower than the levels that the remediation goals that are derived for the protection of ecological risk. So in that regard, by targeting the human risk, you are also targeting the ecological risk.
Okay. All right. Well, Carl, I think we have reached very close to our end time, and I have a few reminders that I want to walk the audience through. But before I start doing that, I want to thank you very much for your time and your expertise. We've had a number of comments coming in from the attendees thanking you for some of the examples you were giving them, and that it's been really helpful, and this has been a great presentation. So I want to be sure to relay that feedback from the audience. And just before I take over to do the final reminders, any last messages you want to leave them with?
My thanks to everybody for hanging in there. And as I mentioned, if you want to chat further, I gave you my email and I'm happy to set up a time. Gene, thank you for all your technical expertise.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and take over sharing the screen here. And I'm going to go ahead and walk through just a few quick final reminders for our audience today. So the first thing that I want to do is just remind everybody that you are welcome to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. And I also encourage you to visit that site and sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. And it'll highlight web resources, documents, training, events, online seminars like today's session related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. So we encourage you to become a subscriber today. The other thing that I wanted to remind everybody of is that all of the presentation materials are currently posted on the seminar homepage. So that's the same URL that we emailed you when you registered. It's the same place you went when you checked in. And that website will be available from today forward. So you can certainly bookmark it and use it to reference later on. And on that homepage, there are some tabs, and you'll find the slides on the webinar slides tab. If you have any problems downloading the PDF copy of the slides, please let me know. I'll be happy to work with you to get you a copy, but they are currently posted. And on that homepage, you'll also find the seminar feedback form. And I will ask each and every one of you to fill out that brief feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery. We'll share your feedback with Carl as well. And one of the most common questions that I get as a moderator is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our seminars. And while I do not issue those types of credit hours, I can provide you, as noted, as a copy of your registration email when you signed up. You can download a copy of the presentation material from the seminar homepage. And if you fill out the seminar feedback form, there's a box at the bottom that you can check to certify you are here for the entire session. And then we will, once you submit your feedback form, issue a certificate of participation that you can save or print out for your own records. And so many attendees take that documentation and they're able to get credit with their own accrediting institution. But you have to be sure to fill out the seminar feedback form, and you have to check that box at the bottom before you submit it in order to get a certificate. If there were multiple people who joined from your location, all you need to do is get them the link to the seminar homepage, and each person who sat in with you, if you did a viewing party, can fill out the feedback form, get their own certificate, And even though they didn't register individually, and they can keep that certificate for their records. So I ask those of you who did sign up to be sure to share that seminar homepage link with those who joined you at your location. And today's session was recorded and will be available for on-demand playback through the Kluwen website. So if you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of today's seminar, you can still access that seminar homepage and fill out that feedback form. So if you look just above my head in the archive on the recorded version, there'll be a link to the seminar feedback form that you can click now and fill that out and still get a certificate based off of replaying today's archive. So we'll send out an email with instructions on how to access that recorded session in about 1 week to all of our registered participants. So with that, I want to thank Carl. I want to thank the organizing teams and the other support staff who joined us for today's session. And I also want to thank the over 450 people who joined us for today's live broadcast. I know that there were a lot of questions that came in. I know that we didn't get through all of them today, but I'll be working to relay the questions that came in to our team and see if we can get some additional responses after our session today. So with that, again, I'll thank everybody for joining us today, and we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much.